Hi, this is WWR, Windwise Radio.
Coming to you from high atop a not-so-windy mountain in the Berkshires of western Massachusetts. Tonight, we will be talking to Eileen Anderson and Miriam Raftery. Eileen is the biologist and Public Lands Deserts Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Miriam Raftery is the editor and founder of East County Magazine. Miriam has written dozens of in-depth articles and investigative reports on wind energy. Welcome back. This is Windwise Radio. I'm Harley Keisch. I'm your host for this evening, and this is a lovely evening here in western Massachusetts. We've had a day that was full of sunshine and not so full of wind turbines, so I count that as a good day. I'm joined tonight by two remarkable women. Eileen Anderson works for the Center for Biological Diversity. She is a biologist and a botanist, and she is involved in their deserts protection program. And I'm also joined by a journalist who works. She founded an online news site. The site is called East County Magazine. It's a very successful effort to bring some independent news to the East County of San Diego, east part of San Diego County, and out into the desert regions, out towards El Centro and all of that. So I'm very delighted to have both of them here tonight. We have, of course, a lot on our plate to talk about. The original impetus for this show, I was thinking about doing something that was focused on primarily on wildlife and birds and so forth. I spoke with several people here on the East Coast side of things, and including Kelly Fuller from the American ABC, it's the American Bird Conservation Society, and many of these organizations have declined to come on the show for unstated reasons. It seems like it's a little bit of a hot potato for them. So I'm glad that we are joined with some people, and I intend to return to the effort to get some of the ornithologists on this side of the world to come on my show and talk about things, the impacts of industrial scale wind turbines in sensitive sites. And that's really, I think, always a big issue. You know, there may be places where, as an alternative energy source, wind turbines might be appropriate, but in a flyway or in a place where raptors hunt, or when you haven't done something that's more appropriate, like maybe distributed solar, in my opinion, it's a hard sell. And now that the federal government is fast-tracking projects in BLM lands on national forests, and state governments are following in that line and doing state forests, I think, though, there's a large danger to take some of our most precious natural resources and turn them into industrial power plants for perhaps not the best reasons. So that's my opinion. I want to hear the opinions of my guests. So I'm going to bring them on. Eileen and Miriam, are you with us?
Yes.
Hi. Hi, good evening.
Hi, Chris.
So I want to start with a quick question for Eileen, and I wonder if you could help all of our listeners out and give a description of the basic setting of this. I know there are many projects going on. There's a lot of both solar and wind development slated for the deserts of southwestern California, or actually, I guess it's eastern California, but the southwest portion of this country, in the deserts of California and the valleys out there, the mountain passes of the southern Sierra and so forth. Can you give us a little bit of a layout of what the scope of all that is, how many, you know, an idea about how many there are, and what's driving all this?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk a little bit about some of the existing wind resources. You know, wind energy is not new to California. And we have basically three different locations currently that have extensive wind farms in them. One of them is up about around the San Francisco Bay Area, the famous Altamont Pass, which has significant wind development in it already and has been noted for the number of raptor kills that have occurred there. But down in the southern part of the state, we have two big wind areas that were developed basically back in the 80s when there were subsidies for building renewable energy projects, including wind. And those two areas are basically the Tehachapi Mountains, which are sort of a southern extension of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And there's been a fairly extensive wind farms in there since the early 80s. That has been a focus for additional wind development in and around that area, for which we have concerns, and I can talk a little bit more about that later.
Okay.
And then the San Gregorio Pass, which is fairly close to Palm Springs, and again, a historically large wind development area that already has lots of existing turbines because the wind blows there all the time.
Now, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to cover the issues about, well, you know, why is there all of a sudden this surge in wind development currently? And it stems from a number of factors. One of them is, of course, California has a very ambitious renewable energy goal. We call it our Renewable Portfolio Standard, which was signed into law that requires basically our utility companies to have 33% of their energy from renewable energy sources by 2020. And so there's been this de facto big push to get all sorts of renewable energy either in California or nearby California, particularly our load centers, which tend to be in Southern California where most of the population lives. So the greater Los Angeles, San Diego urban area is you know, where there's been a lot of focus on bringing renewable energy into that area. And, of course, adjacent to those big urbanized areas are our local deserts, which has really been the focus for a lot of development, whether it be wind or solar development.
Now, Eileen, have you seen the movie Windfall?
You know, I haven't yet, Harley, but I look forward to it.
Okay.
Saw it last week, yes.
Now there's a line in the movie, and actually it's quoted in the trailer for the movie, too. And there's a gentleman, and they're just starting to think about what it would mean for this small town in upstate New York, Meredith, New York, to have 400-foot tall wind turbines in their town. And the line goes something like, he says, out west they put these on 6,000-acre tracts. We don't have anything like that around here. We have neighborhoods. So, of course, you know, there's this kind of, I think, myopia here on the East Coast a little bit about the fact that these deserts, yeah, there might be 6 or 12 or 20,000-acre tracts, but these are precious lands. I mean, these landscapes are not just like some parking lot or something, right?
Well, they are beautiful and pristine. This is Miriam. But also, it's quite a misunderstanding to think that people don't live there. The town of Ocotillo, where the Ocotillo Express wind farm is going, has people whose homes are going to be surrounded on three sides by 450, 496-foot tall turbines that are less than half a mile away. These are taller than the Statue of Liberty. With blade sweeps that are each the size of a football field. And, you know, there are definite health impacts and concerns on residents, as well as the impacts on terribly sensitive cultural resources, biological resources, wildlife, and view sheds.
So I think that I, 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 I definitely agree with what you're saying, and I think that when I say myopia, I think there's this impression that there's nothing, you know, this vast landscape with no creatures living in it, human or otherwise, and that's not really true at all. The desert is a living biosphere. It's, you know, it's, there are many creatures there, and many endangered species are living in those areas. For example, Eileen, can you name a few of the, you know, the endangered species that are in the areas that are being impacted by wind development?
Sure. For instance, Miriam just talked about the Ocotillo Express Wind Project, which is going in on public lands around the town of Ocotillo, but also adjacent to that, to the town of Ocotillo, is great habitat for a very rare species. It's been listed under both a California Endangered Species Act and the Federal Endangered Species Act. It's called the Peninsular Bighorn Sheep, and they basically have live in this very narrow band of habitat, very steep habitat, right along the edge of the peninsular ranges, which are the range between coastal Southern California and the deserts of Southern California. And they only live on the desert side. And this is a species that has been listed for a number of years. The good news is that from a low number of individuals, I think it was down to 700 or so animals across this range, the numbers have increased recently due to conservation efforts, and we're very concerned about the fact that with these industrial projects going in, that the species, the gains that have been made in species recovery are going to basically be impacted, and we're going to see additional declines. The species does go down into Baja, Mexico, and there's some huge wind farms also proposed down in that area, and so, you know, this range for the species is shrinking substantially because of these developments, and that's never good for large mammals.
Right. Does anyone know what the impact, or have an idea of what the impact of industrial scale development like this is going to have on that animal?
I can speak to that. Oh, go ahead. This is Miriam. Well, we are already seeing impacts on the bighorn sheep in our area. In the McCain Valley, which is right up the hill from where the Ocotillo facility will be, that's Bureau of Land Management land. It's approved for yet another wind farm, Tule Wind, which has not been built yet. But what we have had is construction of the Sunrise Powerlink high voltage lines with dozens of helicopters and trucks buzzing around there all at one time.
Now, where does that run from, this Powerlink?
It runs from the desert. Actually, it runs through Ocotillo, which is one reason they want to site these facilities there, up through Acumba, McCain Valley, Boulevard area, where the other wind plant is supposed to go, and then on into San Diego and up to L.A. from there. But the problem is that the sheep have been frightened, clearly, by all the construction going on in the McCain Valley area. There's been a number of very unusual sightings in recent weeks where they were spotted down on the freeway. The CHP has actually had to get out with bullhorns and shoo them off of the freeway. And the area that they were running to, the other side of the road, is designated, it used to be designated as critical sheep habitat, and it was removed by the Bureau of Land Management that recently cut the critical habitat in half. The part that was removed is mostly the wind farm area, most of the wind farm facility in Ocotillo. So we actually had photographers who took photographs of these endangered animals standing on the boundary of the wind farm site where the Bureau of Land Management and the project developer claimed that they did not exist. We sent them photos. It included radio tracking tags and collars with numbers clearly visible as proof, thinking that they would protect the animals and perhaps remove some more turbines or cancel the entire project, not approve it. And instead, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is supposed to have a very clear mission to protect wildlife, especially endangered species, authorized take permits, which would allow the actual deaths or killing of up to up to 10 bighorn sheep, including 5 ewes and 5 lambs. And Secretary Ken Salazar, the Secretary of the Interior, signed the final notice of approval for this project last week, and the bulldozing is beginning as we speak.
Now, you're a journalist. Have you tried to reach out to Salazar's office and ask him whether, you know, what his thinking was, what was the process? Did he know when he signed it that he was signing the death warrant for these animals, or have you tried?
We've had no answers. We've contacted the BLM, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. We've even sent a letter to the White House asking if the president is aware of this, or, you know, or could intervene, and we've had no answer from anyone, which I find extremely distressing.
Do either of you know anything about the process by which the critical habitat was delisted, or whatever you want, or cut in half, or whatever you? I don't know exactly what the process. Do you know what the details of that was? It was just like one day they decided, oh well, we need to make this happen, or.
And we've actually been very much involved in the critical habitat designation. And just to clarify, critical habitat is a designation that's done by the Fish and Wildlife Service under the Endangered Species Act. And it basically identifies area that's critical for the survival of the animals. And this has been in and out of court for years. We've been involved with all of the litigation. And it's kind of messy to go into all of the details, but suffice it to say that there was an original designation of a very robust critical habitat that helped set the animals on the road to recovery. And as development, not just wind development, but developments in different parts of the species range wanted to move forward, there was basically political pressure put on Fish and Wildlife Service to go back and look at that designation and redo it. There was basically a court case that challenged that the original designation, and Fish and Wildlife Service went back and through a whole public process where they proposed critical habitat, and we had the opportunity to comment on their process and look at that at their proposal and their methodology, and then they take those comments back and look at them and make a final decision about it. And they did shrink the habitat substantially, left it not connected, which for particularly terrestrial species like bighorn sheep is important in keeping genetics robust in the population. We've been very concerned about this and, in fact, have current litigation against Fish and Wildlife Service over the newest designation. And are very, very concerned with regards to the Ocotillo project and the old critical habitat, if you will, which was identified previously, not being included and, in fact, now being developed.
This also borders the Anzabarego State Park. It shares a 5-mile border with the state park, and we interviewed the former superintendent of the park, Mark Jorgensen, who came forward as a whistleblower, to tell us that people within the Park Service were extremely concerned about the impacts on the park, including the bighorn sheep and other wildlife, and especially this connectivity of corridors, and that, unfortunately, they spent 2 months preparing a comment to submit for the EIS, and were told 1 day before, 2 days before, they got a call from on high ordering them not to submit it. The state parks people were apparently muzzled. He was told this was a call from the governor's office. The governor's office has denied this. However, the Borrego Sun went out and interviewed additional people close to state parks who all confirmed that, yes, indeed, there was, you know, such an order, and they were told not to speak out about the negative impacts of this project on the largest state park in the California state park system.
Well, isn't Anzabarego the largest state park anywhere? I mean, it's huge, right?
It could be. I'm not certain.
I think it's one of the largest parks in the United States. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a vast area. I've been there and hiking, and it's beautiful mm-hmm. there. I mean, it's very rugged, and it's a beautiful place. I lived in San Diego for a number of years, and I've been hiking out in those deserts, and it really is a personal thing for me. Emotionally, I'm attached to those places, as I'm sure many people are. They're interesting. Where was I when all of this litigation was going on? I kind of want to talk a little bit, Eileen, about your organization. Your organization is an organization that does conservation, but you also do a lot of litigation, right? Is that true?
Yes, that's true. Our focus is on maintaining rare and endangered species in their habitats. So that's always the nexus for us. And, we oftentimes challenge, when all else fails, challenge projects in court.
Now, it's interesting because I don't know what the story is out in California, out west, but out here, a lot of the mainstream, I'll call them mainstream, environmental organizations that you would normally think would be allies to be protecting the landscapes and the wildlife habitats are actually on the opposite side a lot on these sighting issues. Are you finding that's true out there, are you getting a little bit more support from people like the Sierra Club?
The Sierra Club, what we're seeing in our area, this is Miriam, is that many of the local Sierra Club officials are very opposed to these particular wind projects. But when they've asked their statewide chapter, to come out against it, they're told no, that per directive from National, they cannot do that. National apparently has bought into the idea that saving the planet from global warming, which is an important problem. I believe in global climate change as a huge problem that does need to be addressed. I just think that, like you, that the siting is key on these wind projects and that they're going into a lot of inappropriate places where, San Diego and Ocotillo, hello, these are desert areas where 100% of our region is ideal for solar. Why are we not doing the obvious rooftop and parking lot solar instead? That said, there are some environmental groups that have stepped forward. We're seeing Basin and Range Watch very actively opposing this Ocotillo project. We're seeing the Desert Protective Council actively opposing it. But you do have to wonder, where is the Sierra Club? Where is the Audubon Society? The Eagle Kills is another tremendous project. We only have 47 nesting pairs of golden eagles left in San Diego County, and many of them are, forage in the areas where these wind farms are going in. So are we going to have any of them left? You've got to wonder.
So the issue with, this was the actual issue that was impetus for this, this topic for the show was the impact on our feathered friends, the golden eagles, the red-tailed hawks, the burrowing owls, the songbirds that are migrating. There's a lot of these species of bird species are not exactly, these things are not bird friendly. Is that true? Are they?
That's absolutely true. And apart from, what we know can happen with an authorized project, we're actually even seeing in the construction phase, rules just trampled. I have to say, there's not been a single Bureau of Land Management monitor out there that we could find. We've had three photographers on site, and they're telling us they're basically acting as the monitors, and they've been seeing marked off stakes for burrowing owl holes that were bulldozed right over. And that's just the construction. Then you get into building them, and certainly we know there's been thousands of eagles alone killed over the years at the Altamont Wind Farm, which is the most notorious of them. Bats' lungs will explode from the air pressure. They don't even have to hit the blade. Certainly songbirds. And then apart from the obvious of a flying creature actually hitting the blade, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife itself has a report that says that infrasound, which is not just the noise you hear, but infrasound is the noise you can't hear. It's low-frequency sound waves, which can travel through walls, it can travel through the human body, that actually can have some very negative impacts on wildlife. These things can interfere with certain species' ability to communicate. It can frighten the animals away. In humans, we know that people who live near wind farms complain of things like chest pressure, headaches, ear pain. There have been instances of livestock very near wind farms where the milk would, dairy cows would stop producing enough milk. There's been, I don't know enough to say conclusively that it's caused by wind farms, but there have been some troubling anecdotal stories of, you know, horse ranchers and other kinds of farmers near these farms where all of a sudden the animals had very high stillbirth and miscarriage rates. You know, one horse rancher who all of a sudden had like all seven of his mares either, you know, miscarried or aborted, aborted or had stillborn or deformed fetuses. And you have to wonder how safe are these things, you know, for anybody. So it's troubling. Chickens near them have been known to lay shellless eggs, and we see this in many parts of the world. Also, there can be what they call stray voltage or dirty electricity, which can be stray voltage in the air, stray voltage in the ground. At very high levels, from other sources of stray voltage off of power lines and things, it's been known to electrocute and kill entire herds of cattle. What happens if that happens around these bighorn sheep, you know? And it's not just an abstract concept. At the wind farm that we have currently on some tribal land here in San Diego's East County, recently the author of the book Dirty Energy, who's an epidemiologist, came out, took measurements, and because people were getting sick and they were asking for his help, and he measured ground current at over 1,000 times the normal rate inside the tribal hall and the tribal church, right in the tribe where people were getting, Indian tribe where people were getting sick. So this is another thing. What, you know, there are photos. Google dancing cows on YouTube, and you'll find actual pictures of cows in fields where there's too high of ground current levels, and they're actually lifting their hooves up and down, you know, very agitated, trying to get away from this. So clearly, these are things that need to be looked at. You know, the dirty electricity issue should be a solvable one, but only if you make them solve it. Why is this one out here that's been producing such high levels for such a long time still in operation? Why are these things not shut down if they're causing something like that and being made to not leak dirty electricity anymore?
Those are all good questions, and definitely there's a wide range of impacts from turbines, some that are, you know, more. I think that science is still, you know, very formative on some of the things and some things that's more well settled. But I want to talk a little bit about the California condor. Now, at one point, not too long ago, I think the entire species was down to something like 40 individual birds.
I believe it was 19 at one point.
Was it that low? I thought there were some that were in captivity and they trapped the last 20 wild birds or something. But in any case, it was a very low number. And I suppose millions of dollars have now been spent on breeding programs and conservation efforts and an attempt to bring the condors back. They've been released. Some have been released into the wild now, half of which have GPS trackers. So, Eileen, can you tell us a little bit about? I was very jealous when I was talking to Eileen during the prepping for the show, and she told me that she had seen, had the experience of seeing the condors flying wild, and I have not.
Oh, wow!
I'm very, very jealous about that. But Eileen, can you tell us a little bit about the condor and what its behavior is like? I have a question about. I understand that they have sort of there are alpha males and things like that. They tend to have a social order.
Condors, you know, they're a great example of actually the success of the Endangered Species Act, you know, through this basic genetic bottleneck that they went through with having such low population numbers, and the determination, as you know, was to bring them all in from the wild and start a captive breeding program. And that's been very successful through fits and starts. They have had their problems, but now we actually have more condors out in the wild than in the captive breeding program, and they're successfully reproducing in the wild, which is the goal for recovery for the species.
That's so great. It's so great.
It's really a fantastic story, and especially for such an iconic and majestic bird. I mean, they are, mm-hmm. you can't really mistake them for anything else when you see them, because there's just nothing quite like them. Largest bird in North America.
Wingspan is what, 9-10 feet, something like that?
Yeah, 9 feet. Uh-huh, yep. And they're fairly social birds, and they take about 4 years to mature. So you have, juveniles that hang out with older adults and sort of learn the ropes of being a condor, so to speak.
Hmm.
And so the mature birds, especially some of the, they live for quite a long time, 40 to 50 years.
Wow.
In the wild. And so these, the birds that were brought into captivity during their captive breeding program, and then re-released after the program was well established. These are really key individuals for teaching the younger birds, where the habitat range is, sort of how to be a condor and how to act like a condor. And there was
So, Eileen, are you saying that some of the actual individuals that were trapped and brought into a captive breeding have been reinduced into the wild? They've gained their freedom back?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, some of them, mm-hmm. some of the females basically quit reproducing, had, done their thing, and
right.
in their dotage were re-released so that they could basically train the youngsters on where to go and, how to mm-hmm. find food and all that.
They do the training program right here at our San Diego Zoo, so it's quite fascinating to read about it. But I do have the numbers here. They were down in 1982 to just 22 individuals, and they
wow.
were all taken into captivity, the last one in 1987.
Wow.
And today, at least as of March 2011, the latest numbers I have, it's back to 369, of which 191 are in the wild.
I mean, it's such an inspiring story. I mean, it's really remarkable effort, a huge success for the people that are involved with this effort, for the legislation that created an environment in which a species like this could be given a second chance. The fact that some of these individuals are actually being re-released and regaining their freedom is just remarkable.
The other interesting thing is that they are re-inhabiting their old range, which includes not only the coastal range of California, but the Sierra Nevada mountains. And therein sort of lies the rub for the conflict with wind farms, because where the wind farms are currently from the 1980s and the new farms that are being built are in basically getting into direct conflict with the range of the California condor in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. And there's grave concern, I know, not only by environmental organizations, but also by the state and federal wildlife agencies about the fate of the condor with regards to the wind industry. And
they are they are releasing some of these in Mexico, starting, populations down there. And I was just at a conference where they showed a map of where proposed wind facilities are, and it's smack on top of the heart of the ranges where these condors have been re-released. So, I worry a lot about what's going to happen to them and if they may have to take them back into captivity again to attempt to save them from some of these wind facilities.
So they're obviously slow to reproduce, because if they're caring for their young for 4 years, a breeding pair, are they monogamous like that? Or are they?
To clarify, actually, they don't care for their young for 4 years. It just takes 4 years for the birds to mature. They lay eggs about every other year, though, so it is a very slow reproductive rate.
How many in a clutch?
Usually one.
One, and wow, huh?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So, yeah.
So, and there's other threats to the species as well. We have a whole campaign on getting lead out of condor country in California.
And the lead would be what in birdshot and things like that.
Correct.
More any hunting, so that and you know condors are carrion feeders, so they basically you know whatever dead animals out there that's been shot and left, that's how they get the lead poisoning. It's been a real issue for condors.
So they swallow they swallow the bullets that's in the carcass and then they get poisoned by it.
Yeah, sadly, in our San Diego area, it is not considered designated habitat for the condor, although the first wild condor seen in San Diego in over 100 years was spotted in East County, very close, actually, to where one of these wind farms will be about 4 years ago.
Well, so there's this huge threat. How long before the Fish and Wildlife Department starts to issue take permits for condors?
Well, there's been an in, basically they could issue them now if they wanted to. There's no, even though they're protected under Endangered Species Act, they can still give take permits for species. And in fact, there's a development in condor habitat, condor critical habitat, that is requesting a take permit, although not a lethal take permit. Under the law, take also involves harassing of animals, touching of animals, hazing of animals off of sites, that sort of thing, as well as there's the lethal take. So it's, you know...
It's up to and including the death of an animal.
So yeah, what's the justification for these take permits, whether it's a condor, a golden eagle, a burrowing owl, or a bighorn, peninsular bighorn sheep? And I mean, they have to be saying some. What's the language that they use that justifies this kind of? I haven't
really seen it. I can only speculate that the justification is a greater good sort of argument, that somehow the need to address climate change or produce clean energy supersedes these long-held protections for the wildlife. But in my mind, frankly, you know, there really is no justification. To me, if you cannot build a project that's not going to result in the slaughter of endangered or protected species, then that project shouldn't be built. And for that particular region, you should look at another type of solution to your energy issues. And there certainly are many other alternatives that could be looked at and many other locations that can be looked at. I keep wondering how long it's going to take for somebody in Congress to sit up and pay attention to what's happening and to say we need some legislation to put a stop to these kill permits and have some more public oversight of what's going into these things. And it's also part of this fast-tracking process. A lot of people were horrified to see these things in these final orders. Nobody knew that was in there in time to speak out at the public meetings because of the massive numbers of documents, document dumps where people would be given hundreds of pages, in some cases hours before a final hearing, you know, where final approval would be given, an EIR that is several feet tall, 5,500 pages. Nobody has time to read the entire thing in the very limited time you're given, let alone when changes, hundreds of pages long, are handed to attorneys, in some cases tribes that have objected. The tribes are trying to protect the eagles and their artifacts and sacred sites. In some cases, you know, an hour or two before a critical hearing. So I don't think anyone would say that that is a fair or a transparent process, and possibly if the public knew, they could speak out, although the public did speak out on many other serious problems with these projects that I've been tracking, and at least in Ocotillo, they were essentially ignored by planners who were gung-ho for something that was going to bring jobs to the region, at least that was the promise, as well as tax revenues. Pattern Energy promised $150 million in tax revenues over 5 years, and that's an awful lot of money to throw at an area that has the highest unemployment rate in the nation.
So money drives a lot of decisions that might otherwise be driven by sort of more long-range values about land conservation or species preservation or those mm-hmm. kinds of things. Do you think that we're just not doing a good enough job of getting the word out that these impacts need to be thought about and a judgment made about whether the benefit of a wind turbine versus something like distributed solar on rooftops in San Diego or L.A., you know?
Well, yes. And it's funny you should mention that, because what the San Diego Planning Commission did when they were considering a wind ordinance that would have made it easier to build these giant wind farms, you know, one of them turned around and said, you know, even though our direction from supervisors on this EIS, EIR, which is a joint document, you know, with federal and everybody else, even though it says we're just supposed to evaluate, you know, wind versus, you know, big wind versus small wind projects, we think we should go back and reopen up the entire EIS, EIR, and say we want to evaluate rooftop solar and parking lot solar as a viable alternative to this thing. And so they've directed their staff to go back and produce a report on what it would take to do that, and that's going to be heard again June 8th. But at any rate, so some places around the country are sitting up and saying, wait a minute, maybe we need to take a closer look, you know, at this, and I wholeheartedly applaud those planners for, you know, for doing that.
Now, solar itself is not without its own siting issues, right? I mean, you guys have experience with that as well. I was watching a video. There was a conference in San Diego, and a professional engineer, and I've forgotten his name. You might be able to help me. He was talking about there was a solar thermal project out in the desert, and it displaced a lot of desert tortoises. And he was talking about the economics of this solar thermal project and how much dollars per kilowatt they were able to bring electricity from.
Bill Powers.
Yes, that's exactly who it was.
But yeah, I think we need to draw a distinction between, again, the industrial scale desert solar projects versus solar on the already built environment, parking lots and rooftops, and actually in the PG&E distribution area, where there are some modest subsidies, nothing like what the wind industry is getting. It is actually now less expensive, according to Bill Powers, the engineer that spoke, for PG&E to buy solar energy from moderate-sized rooftop solar projects than it is to purchase it from wind farms. So why, you have to ask the question of why are we doing these things that are so environmentally destructive?
I want to ask that question to both of you. Why do you think, what's your opinion about why we aren't doing more of this sort of distributed rooftop?
Because there's no profit margin there is no profit incentive for the large corporations. And who's back there lobbying, and who's back there pushing Congress to give them subsidies? Big industry, and let's make no mistake about it, many of these wind companies are owned by giant oil companies. Same with the large solar companies. We have BP, British Petroleum, BP Solar trying to build a solar farm in San Diego's East County. Pattern Energy, Iberdrola, these are all companies that have interests in oil, gas. They're traditional energy companies that are now learning they can make a profit off of green energy. But where is the money to be made by SDG&E, a utility company, an energy company, if everybody puts solar on their rooftops and either goes off grid or just tries to produce excess power and sell it back into the grid? So that's the problem. We do have areas like Sacramento that have formed their own municipal utility districts. And, you know, it's great, and everybody can sell power back into the grid and make a profit if they want to. But it's very difficult politically to get that sort of thing through and to get the decision makers in Sacramento and in Washington, many of whom have taken huge campaign contributions. And you know, we look at David Hayes, I think his name is. He's the former SDG&E Semper Energy lobbyist who's now the second in command at the Department of the Interior in Washington. So, you know, I do think it is a matter of educating the decision makers. I think there are some who would do the right thing if they're informed and they're educated more. And I think that people and environmentalists and citizens need to start speaking up and saying, wait a minute, we want to have some more choices here. I mean, there may be an area where wind is the best option or nuclear, but there's certainly other areas where rooftop solar is the best option. There may be an area where desert solar is, you know, the best option. But we need to look at the true cost and the lifetime cost of these projects, and that includes not just what it costs to stick it up out of the ground, but what it costs, what is it, how much energy is used to build these massive turbines? How much energy is used to transport them, many of them, many times from overseas all the way to the United States? And then now what we're hearing is the wind doesn't blow all the time, so we need to put up natural gas-powered peaker power plants for when the wind doesn't blow. Hello, that's not green. So by the time you're subtracting all those things off, and then we saw a really interesting thing happen in the documents for the Ocotillo project. All along, they've been saying it's going to power 130,000 homes. At one point, 140, eventually 130,000 was what they said when they sold it to the supervisors and to the Planning Commission in Imperial Valley. 1 week later, when Salazar, Secretary Salazar, signed the final order, that number mysteriously went down to 25,000 homes. I thought, is this a typo? And we looked all through, and it's in there several places. What happened? What happened, Harley, to the 105,000 missing homes? Was the whole thing just a scam?
Well,
why are taxpayer dollars, why is someone in Congress, I hope someone is listening, somebody should be saying, wait a minute, we want to halt this project, immediate moratorium, until they explain to us what happened to those missing 105,000 homes. How can you just take taxpayer dollars, give it to this company that all of a sudden turns around and reduces by four-fifths in the final document the amount of power it says it's going to produce?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of explaining to do. I will say that you know, sometimes I feel like some of the mainstream environmental organizations like Audubon, National Audubon, are almost in cahoots with this whole thing, just to get a seat at the table. I know myself and a large number of my friends and the people that I've been involved with out here are refusing to send any more money to Audubon until they change their policy and their stance on things like as simple a thing as, you know, signing on to the ABC BirdSmart program, where they want to have mandatory standards rather than these voluntary guidelines. And, you know, having done the research for this show, I know at least one place where I'm going to start sending my checks, and that is to Eileen's organization. They seem to have at least some, you know, sense of the of values and moral compass and a purpose other than to just like be part of the gang or whatever it is that's driving some of these people. I don't really understand how somebody like a organization like Audubon or just a governmental organization like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that are charged with protection of species could go down these paths and not take a real hard look at themselves and say, what are they doing?
I think we need a congressional investigation. Somebody should be looking into why these agencies aren't doing their jobs, and State of California as well, to say why were state parks people muzzled?
Yeah,
if that order was given, who gave it? You know, what can we do? But you're right that citizens, there are things that we as citizens can do, and certainly a good example of this kind of activism working is with the we saw it with the AARP, American Association of Retired Persons. When they were supporting, I believe it was privatization of Social Security or something that was going to basically, you know, radically change the Social Security program and result in essentially less benefits for most people. And a lot of members turned around and canceled their membership. You know, and they got the message loud and clear, and they changed their position on that. So, you know, your money does talk with these things. Another thing that I'm seeing done is you know, pressure on the banks. I've seen instances around the country where people sometimes stopped a project by pressuring a bank that was going to lend the money and going to them and saying, wait a minute, this is a horrific project. It's bad for our community. Don't give these guys, you know, the money. We're hearing about, you know, that kind of thing being effective. And just getting the word out to the media. In San Diego, we had a famous case of Blackwater wanting to build a training camp and backing down amid massive national pressure. The people all got together. They staged a march through the forest to show what was going to be destroyed if this project was built. They had the international media. They had CNN, Al Jazeera, the BBC, the New York Times all out there marching through the forest with them. And I think even Blackwater admitted that it's matched. This was going to be a nightmare of a PR project for them. And they pulled out ostensibly claiming they couldn't meet noise mitigation requirements, but they'd known for a long time what that cost was going to be. And
Now, Miriam, the mainstream media, the mm-hmm. print and so forth, I mean, and I consider you, you know, an outlet that is well within that kind of parameter. Mm-hmm. You have a news partner in ABC 10, right? Channel 10
mm-hmm.
News.
We do.
Most of the mainstream media has taken a very different stance on a very kind of, I mean, I keep saying to my friends, I wish they'd just have one good investigative journalist in all of Massachusetts. I'd like to meet him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
mm-hmm.
you seem to be doing this great work as an independent journalist. Do you take a lot of flack? That's the first question. And do you find yourself having a difficult time getting answers from people just based on the fact that you're more adversarial, more investigative, and less mm-hmm. sort of cozying up to these people? And then second, I mentioned, and I want to talk again to Eileen about this, but I mentioned that that people can send checks. You're partly supported by donations, is that correct?
We are nonprofit. So I think the biggest, I guess from an organizational standpoint, the biggest negative we've felt of doing what we do is that unlike almost all the other media in town that is supported very largely with a lot of donations or advertising if they're for profit by, you know, SDG&E and some of the big energy companies, we have not taken their money because we want to be able to report honestly on the issues. That doesn't mean, you know, we won't ever report if a company does something positive. We certainly do when they're doing charitable contributions in the community. We are fair with Iberdrola. We walked the wind farm with them. We gave them a chance to do an interview. They were very forthcoming and answered a lot of questions about their projects. They did show us they had mitigated certain things. They did a lot on fire safety, for example. Pattern, by contrast, has pretty much refused to answer any question about anything, even seismic safety, which is a whole other issue. They're putting these things right on or very near very active earthquake faults on sand over water over an aquifer capable of liquefaction, which we thought, you know, you should be willing to ask questions about, and they weren't, not even to ABC 10 News. But, yes, we absolutely welcome donations. You know, I mean, this is the heart and soul of how we fund our investigative journalism is through community support. You know, we are your media. We're the public media. And, you know, we're going to tell the truth no matter what that is, no matter whether it's somebody I voted for or I voted against or, you know, sometimes the same company may do a good thing one place and a bad thing somewhere else. So that's the heart and soul of journalism, is just getting the facts and telling the truth.
Now, we're gonna take a caller who wants to make a comment on some of the national environmental organizations. Terry, are you with us?
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Good evening, Terry, or I guess good afternoon mm-hmm. if you're calling from, it looks like, the San Diego area.
Yeah, correct. My name is Terry Wainer. I'm the staff for the Desert Protective Council, and before today I didn't know that your program existed. I'm really grateful. And this is a good show. Thanks so much
for bringing
this to the public. I'll be sure to be letting people know about Windwise Radio, believe me.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
So we are a smaller organization. We're more grassroots, nonprofit desert educational organization. We have never, ever in our 57-year-old history as a nonprofit seen such a massive threat to the health of our deserts from industrial solar and wind projects. To that end, I 2 years ago now co-founded an organization called Solar Done Right, and our whole mission and purpose is to explain to the media and the public and the decision makers that there are alternatives to working with climate change other than, you know, going after the public lands for this. And Miriam touched a little bit on that before, but my observation as a naturalist and a desert educator is that we haven't done our job properly to educate the public about the desert and why it's such an interesting and important ecosystem and how wonderful and beautiful it is. A lot of the national organizations are based in Washington, D.C., NRDC, Defenders of Wildlife, Wilderness Society, and the Sierra Club. And they also have branches up in Northern California. These people are making decisions for an area that they themselves have often never even visited. So, you know, I'm not saying that they're, you know, glibly dismissing the desert, but, you know, they're making decisions working, and you're right. I think that they are addicted to sitting at the table and being part of the negotiating team, and they're making decisions about our deserts without having all the information they need.
And Carrie, you're absolutely right. Carrie's group is going to go. Go ahead.
Scientists are just now beginning to study all aspects of the desert. There's a desert botanist who works for UC Riverside as the UC Riverside Preserve, and he said that there very many species of plants in the desert haven't even been discovered yet, and they're in areas that are being slated for massive wind and solar projects. So my mission is to gather a coalition and start, you know, educating. We should bring out President Obama. We should have done this 2 years ago. And Ken Salazar on a tour of the desert and shown and talked to them about why this soil and plants and animals are important.
We need to save our public land.
Thank you, Carly. My comment.
It's desert, and in our areas, it's also beautiful mountain areas that are threatened with this, too. If you look at the wind resources areas, there's some spectacular mountain areas that are proposed as well.
It's all connected.
And I'd also like to say we would be really remiss if we didn't mention the horrible impact on our Native Americans locally that this is having. Some of these projects, both Ocotillo and Tule Wind, are in areas that are considered sacred by the Native Americans, where they actually still do ceremonies today with multiple tribes gathering there. There's a geoglyph, spokeswheel geoglyph that's huge, and it's on the National Registry of Historic Places. There's something like 10,000 artifacts, you know, there are many cremation sites. The project builder did not do its due diligence, and the tribes actually hired forensic dog teams to go out themselves this week and found six additional cremation sites that the dogs alerted on, and still this developer won't stop this project. The Indians have gone to court. They've asked for a temporary restraining order. We don't know yet if Judge Hayes will grant it, but meanwhile, you know, they're going and they're digging these big, deep, there's an area where they're going to put a pond in, and there was no talk about where that was going to go. It's huge. The Indians are absolutely heartbroken. I've seen grown men stand up and cry in these public hearings. They talk about when they were children going to the site, bringing their own children there. Their history is written on the land, in the rocks, and when it's gone, it's gone forever. They lose a part of their past, and they also believe that the animals, the golden eagle is sacred in their culture, some of the others, the view sheds, they're being destroyed. You know, it's not just a view of a pretty place. To the Indians, these are sacred. The spirit pathway, they believe, travels through this spokeswheel geoglyph to the Coyote Mountains, which is in their creation story. That's like putting this on top of the Garden of Eden. You know?
Right. I posted a video of the chairman of the Viejas tribe of Indians, and he was very eloquent about the fact that these lands have been inhabited by their people for 12,000 years, which in their mythology means since the beginning of time. And he was very eloquent about the emotional impact and the value that's being erased by these projects. And I think it is an important piece of social injustice that's happening. Now, Eileen and Miriam, I'm going to take another call from Chris, who wants to comment. Let me see if I can get him on the line with us. Hello, Chris. Chris, can you hear us?
Is that me?
Yes, that's you, Chris.
Okay. Actually,
I hope I got
actually,
your. I hope I got your name right.
Since the name's slightly wrong, I didn't respond. I apologize. My name is Craig, actually, and I'm a friend of Miriam's.
Oh.
Hey, Craig.
Hey, Craig.
Hi, Miriam. How are you?
Thanks for calling.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the contrast between the pretext under which so many of these wind farm projects are being advanced, that they're green projects, and how, paradoxically, they're destroying so much open ground, so much beautiful wilderness space. It seems like the ultimate contradiction to me. I was wondering if either of you would like to comment on that.
I certainly agree with you completely, Craig, on that. To me, it's not green if it's destroying nature. It's like the destroy the village to save it concept that we've heard from, in wartime. It's two wrongs don't make a right in my book, and especially in areas where we have better choices, where we have solar, an abundance of it. Everything is connected in nature. When you start taking away these species, we don't know how far-reaching those impacts will be. We've seen with PowerLink even things like, rattlesnakes being displaced, and you're seeing more of them in neighboring, communities. But these are beautiful, inspiring, natural places. My degree was in environmental studies. I love to get away and go hike up in the mountains, and the thought of these gorgeous places just being destroyed is really deeply, deeply troubling to me, and I think it would be to most Americans if they could see and understand what's being lost. And it isn't just the West. I think you're going to see more and more of this across America. It's energy projects first. This is all part of Dick Cheney and those secret energy meetings and the whole fast-tracking idea of, of building these in public lands all across America, starting with the Southwest. But we're also seeing similar precedents being used. There's now actually a bill in Congress that would open up national parks for certain types of developments along the border regions, and they want to waive all environmental laws. We've seen what waiving all the environmental laws did. If you go down to the Smuggler's Gulch area here, where they did that for the border fence, and I know there were some justifications, national security, and everybody's worried about terrorists coming across the border, but there's a lot of high-tech things they can do with high-tech monitoring, and a lot of this was really not necessary, but certainly to look at doing that along the entire Canadian border, there's something like, I think it's 45 national parks that would be affected by this, where you could have massive swaths of land. And again, it's giving away our public land for private corporations to come in and make some money. And I'm beginning to think more and more that that's what this is really all about. And I think a lot of good people have been deluded and misused and presented maybe not all of the information. And again, they're not seeing what's being destroyed. They're not looking at the total cost of these projects, over the lifetime to build it, to, all the things we talked about before.
I think you're right with that, Miriam. I think that a lot of people on the other side of this issue are very well-intentioned, but haven't really, maybe they have a superficial understanding, or they have this impression that that's been fostered by the industry of, there are no impacts. What could possibly be wrong with wind energy? The wind is free. And I always say, coal is free too, until you have to start moving a mountaintop to get it out.
Can we talk about the falsification of the health reports that's been done on this? I know it's getting near, but I don't think people know that.
Well, hang on a second. I want to get Eileen back into the conversation. Eileen, did you have a response to that, to Craig and his question?
As a matter of fact, and certainly these projects, need to be sustainable, and so much of what I see is we're taking an intact habitat that has species on it that are already trying to adapt to climate change, because we're seeing climate change occurring now. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is we're putting these in places that are essential for species to be able to make those changes, move around on the landscape. We're certainly not going to save endangered species from climate change. They're going to have to do it themselves. And by putting these projects in these places that are
intact habitat where species have a chance to make the move, we're precluding that option for them. And it's very, very concerning.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like we're taking away the very thing that that the species need to adapt, you know, to help
yes.
them adapt.
Yeah.
So, Craig, thank you very much for calling. We're almost out of time. I have one last call. I'd love to get her in, and then I think we're going to have to wrap up.
Okay.
Craig, thank you for your time tonight. Karen is calling from California, and I'd love to hear from her and hear what she wants to talk about. Now, Karen, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Karen. Good evening.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for the program. It's wonderful.
Well, you're welcome. What's your question or comment?
It's more a commentary, I suppose. I just want to relate some of my own experience with solar. I live in a remote part of the, fairly remote part of the Sierra Nevada. And 15 years ago, faced with a choice of hooking up to PG&E or getting solar, I found that the costs were about the same. Both were expensive, but I opted for solar. So I got it, and I don't have a monthly bill. And I think it's time that we, you know, there's a local food movement. I'd love to see a local energy movement where, you know, where there are subsidies for rooftop solar and, encouraging local production of energy for, you know, not only because of, you know, all the reasons that your wonderful guests have explained about the impacts of industrial solar. I think also if people are generating their own, either, you know, on their own place or in their neighborhood, you get a better sense of kind of your energy budget. You have a
sure.
finite amount you're producing, and you use it accordingly, and you make choices about how you use energy.
So it promotes conservation and efficiency.
That's right, yeah.
Correct.
Because, you know, when... It's sort of like if you're on a well as opposed to on city water, and some people think you turn on a tap and there's an endless source.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you're on a well, you realize that at least, you know, in some cases it's not an infinite source.
Hmm.
I think we should all be asking our elected officials, and this is an election year, and the people running for office, where do you stand on, you know, promoting or supporting rooftop solar versus these, you know, more destructive industrial scale energy projects or energy projects on public lands? That's a fair question. It should be asked in every congressional town hall meeting, every mayoral debate. I know Bob Filner, who's running for mayor in San Diego, is a huge advocate of rooftop solar, for example. Some of the people running in some of these other races or in office now have not been supportive of some of these things and have been pushing, you know, the wind energy. So I think that's fair to ask. I think it's fair to ask who's getting money from these corporations. Know what you're voting for.
Well, thank you, Karen, for that comment. I think it's a very wise and insightful comment. And thank you for calling in. We're getting right down to the end, so I'm going to have to wrap things up. But thank you for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for allowing me the opportunity.
You're quite welcome. So,
we appreciate the opportunity to help get the word out.
Now, so Miriam, I'm going to hold your feet to the fire a little bit. Are you going to produce like a little bit of a scorecard for how each of the politicians running this year are trending in their votes on these issues? Are you going to?
Yeah, I should. I love the idea of it. I can't do it for the whole country, but certainly as I'm interviewing some of the congressional candidates here and state legislative candidates, that's definitely on my list of questions that I'm asking them. I have a whole series of energy-related questions because I do think it's extremely important. We will be publishing that information as it gets closer to the election. And I think it's something people should look at everywhere.
Hmm. Well, I do too. I hope that there will be someone around here doing that as well, even if I have to do it myself. So.
Good idea. Well, if you decide to do it at the national level, let us know. Maybe we can get folks in all these wind watch groups around the country to, begin providing that information or questionnaires that could go out.
What we call the index, something like
protect our public lands.
Now, Eileen, can you tell us how do people find your organization? What's the best way they can help you guys in your efforts?
Well, we have a website that talks about some renewable energy projects. There's so many of them right now that it's hard to keep up with. But you can go to our website, www.biologicaldiversity.org, and check out the information there. That'd be a good first step.
Okay, and for people that want to get involved, are people volunteering with you, or if people want to get more involved, what would you suggest?
They can contact me directly, and there's a link on our website to contact me, and I'd be happy to, see how we can collaborate and move in the right direction on a lot of these projects.
And for those of you, I was on Eileen, the website, the Center for Biological Diversity website, and they have a bunch of excellent ringtones that you can get, and they have a newsletter that you can sign up for and all of that. Thank you very much for agreeing to come on, Eileen, and taking the time out tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on, Harley. It was a pleasure.
Okay. And Miriam, I'm going to give you the last word. We have just a couple of minutes. If you can just tell us what do you think what's the most important thing for them to do?
Boy, there's so many things, but I would say, call or send an email to the White House and tell the president that you're concerned about these massive energy projects on public lands and the take permits being issued for the endangered species for these projects. Ask for a moratorium on the fast tracking of energy projects on public lands and contact your congressman. And I also would say, if everybody would do just one thing, I would actually say contact California's Senator Barbara Boxer and let her know your concerns about this. She chairs one of the key environmental committees in Congress, and she's actually in a position where she could take action if enough people were to persuade her that they're deeply concerned about the impacts on our public lands in California and across the Southwest. I don't know if she knows that take permits are being issued. She's on my list to try and call Monday and let her know that. Or that, Native American, there's at least six laws we can find relating to protection of Native American rights that are just being violated and many others in the fast-tracking process. So someone really needs to take a close look at that and perhaps call a moratorium to any more new projects or stopping some of these that are in the pipeline until a really close look is taken at, A, the process, the fast-tracking, B, the impact on the wildlife, and C, whether some tax dollars may perhaps have been misappropriated. When the number of houses goes down by 4/5 all of a sudden with no explanation, maybe that's a company that should be asked where they shouldn't get that subsidy. If it's not going to produce the amount of energy, that alone should be something to raise some eyebrows, I would think.
Thank you very much, Miriam. And we're gonna wrap up. I'm just gonna say that you can always try to do everything to fix a problem, but sometimes I think the smart thing, the intelligent thing, the thing when you're really in a spot is you have to triage and you have to decide you have certain resources. Let's choose the wisest choices. Let's choose in favor sometime of our values. Let's choose on the side of the mountains and the deserts and all of those creatures. Tune in next week. We're going to have another great show at WindWise Radio. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Just a quick note that East County Magazine can be found at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Click the green living button at the top to access their articles on wind energy and more.